Deutsche Welle. Inside Europe.
Hello and welcome to Inside Europe. I'm Helen Sini in Bonn. On today's programme, how much longer can the Swiss maintain banking secrecy? A suicide in Notre Dame highlights the French divide over gay marriage. An operatic twist to Spanish austerity, while the wealthy rev up in Copenhagen.
The attraction of this event is the whole show. I mean, this is incredibly politically incorrect. It is a waste of resources. I mean, it doesn't have a purpose except for displaying wealth and beautiful cars. It definitely doesn't solve the problems of the world, no.
Those stories and more coming up on the programme. European leaders turned up the heat on tax cheats on Wednesday. The EU pledged to end banking secrecy across the 27-member bloc by the end of the year. Officials say tax fraud and evasion costs the EU an estimated 1 trillion euros a year, and that too at a time when much of the region is in recession. But EU countries also believe that much of that money is hidden in non-EU member Switzerland, which is still clinging to its long tradition of banking secrecy. But how much longer can Switzerland resist the pressure to change? Imogen Folks reports from Geneva.
For two centuries, Geneva has been one of the world's leading centres for looking after wealth. Today, the first things you see here are banks. The streets are lined with them. Money and the discreet, confidential management of it has made this city successful. But that long tradition of banking secrecy, which began simply as a way to protect a client's privacy, has, Switzerland's neighbours say, become a tool to siphon billions in foreign tax revenue into Swiss bank accounts.
Every year, around 1 trillion euro is lost in EU member states because of tax evasion and tax avoidance. 100 times more than the loan that was recently agreed for Cyprus.
Herman Van Rompuy, president of the European Council, is angry that everyone with money to hide, from French politicians to German football managers, seems to find a safe bolt hole in a Swiss bank. The European Union and the United States are demanding automatic exchange of bank information, the complete antithesis to banking secrecy. In the Swiss Parliament, there is dismay. Yves Nidegger of the right-wing Swiss People's Party believes his country is being punished for its success.
Wherever I go in the world, it's very fashionable today to say some nasty words about the Swiss and their banks. Now, the fact that the Swiss banks have been taking care of a quarter, about, of the private equity in the world was just too much for a small country like this and a small industry. And those competitors, such as London or New York, and of course the European Union, they declared a war on that.
Geneva's bankers see it as a war as well. I'm on my way to see Michel Desrobert. He's head of the Swiss Association of Private Bankers and a man who today feels besieged.
Certainly we cannot be at war with our neighbours on these issues. That's very clear. We will have to solve that problem. I'm fairly sure about that.
But how to solve it? Should Switzerland surrender? Abandon banking secrecy?
Bankgeheimnis im Inland.
A recent opinion poll caused headlines when it revealed that almost half of Swiss voters would do so. Law professor Philippe Mastronardi believes it is inevitable.
Banking secrecy is dying and it's really turning around very fast now. Switzerland is moving week per week or month per month towards automatic exchange of information. Switzerland is a small nation and has no power to enforce its interests upon other countries.
But while one half of the Swiss would give up secrecy, the other half want to keep it. The political debate has become heated. Member of Parliament Yves Nidegger is not ready to give in. And he's got some quite astonishing bargaining positions.
We could, for example, offer to guarantee the Greek debt. Not to pay it, but to guarantee the Greek... We're the only one who would be able to do that. The Greek bank would become AAA, would be sellable, and the guarantee would be maintained as long as bank secrecy is respected.
Switzerland may have the money to guarantee Greece's debt, but it's unlikely to do so in return for keeping banking secrecy, because the Swiss money men, like banker Michel Desrobiers, are, in the face of all the pressure, beginning to accept what was once unthinkable.
We see the whole world moving towards a single standard. Obviously, we will have to adjust to that standard, because we understand that if a world standard comes to the surface, it will be difficult to remain outside the civilized world.
So Geneva's banks and Zurich's, and indeed all the Swiss banks, are going to have to find a new, more open way of doing business. It seems the numbered accounts are dated, and the days of banking secrecy are numbered.
And that was Imogen Folks reporting there from Geneva. In Paris's Notre Dame Cathedral this week, a far-right essayist committed suicide in front of several hundred tourists. He did this shortly after going on a right-wing radio station to criticise the legalisation of gay marriage. From Paris, John Laurenson has this postcard about the debate that has divided the country in two.
It was 4 o'clock on Tuesday afternoon when an elderly man called Dominique Venet walked into Notre Dame Cathedral. He made his way through the crowds of tourists and faithful till he got to the altar. He placed a letter there, drew out a revolver, put the barrel in his mouth and pulled the trigger. The gay marriage debate has been really special in France. Huge numbers of people are still marching in this country in protest at same-sex marriage, even though the law has now been voted in by Parliament and approved by the Constitutional Council. Britain's Guardian newspaper said these have been the biggest conservative and right-wing street protests in 30 years. This was misleading. They've been the biggest street protests of any sort for 30 years. And they haven't been so terribly conservative or right-wing either, or not at least in the way you might expect. In fact, the Manif pour tous, a demo for all, so-called in response to François Hollande's slogan Marriage for All, has radically changed what it means to be conservative or right-wing in this country. 9 months ago, everyone thought François Hollande's one-line manifesto promise of gay marriage, gay adoption and medically assisted procreation for lesbian couples would slip through the French legislature like a child down one of those water slides at the swimming pool. Like the British Conservative Party, most members of the Conservative UMP were against, but many of their leaders were worried about looking old-fashioned or anti-gay and so weren't expected to put up much opposition. The new law would inexorably lead, its opponents said, to babies carried by surrogate mothers being told they have two fathers, and babies born thanks to artificial insemination being told they have two mothers. The gay, lesbian, bisexual and transgender movement said it was about gay rights. The antis said it was about the right of children to have a father and a mother. Even the children of divorced parents have a father and a mother, they argued, and this is the way it should be. Many gay people in France agree. There's a gay anti-gay marriage group called Homovox and another called Plus Gay Sans Mariage, More Gay Without Marriage, which promotes the idea that gay marriage is a betrayal of the true gay lifestyle. The atmosphere at all these demos is in fact fairly gay, with pink balloons and Britney Spears played really loud. If it wasn't for the presence of old blokes with anoraks and thermos flasks who've come in coaches from Brittany, you'd think this was an event organised by the famous Champs-Élysées nightclub Queen. Those old men from Brittany are how the pro-gay marriage groups, politicians and much of the media have portrayed opponents of the bill, essentially as a bunch of homophobic fascist old gits. But the story is more complicated than that. The demos have in fact been remarkably youthful and good-humoured, and extraordinarily, given the numbers of people who have attended them, homophobic slogans, chanted, sung or written on placards have been absent. It's therefore a bit of a public relations disaster for the anti-gay marriage movement that a man, whose friends even may remember him as a homophobic fascist old git, has been a martyr to their cause. In today's French debate about gay marriage, his description of the thing as vile hours before he killed himself was seriously off message. For pro-gay marriage groups, this, like the beating up of a gay Dutchman in the north of Paris a few weeks ago, is the true face of the antis. But the leaders of this surprising new political force have answers to that. A few weeks ago, asked if he wasn't embarrassed that far-right leader Marine Le Pen was also anti-gay marriage, the head of Plus Gay Sans Mariage, Xavier Bongibaud, replied that if Marine Le Pen said it was a nice day, that wasn't a good enough reason to say that the weather was lousy. And there's one other Frenchman who could use the power of prayer, François Hollande. At the beginning, demonstrators happily chanted to the never-married president, François, marie-toi, François, get married. But the mood is very different today among those who have always opposed him and those who once supported him. After months and months of often bitter debate, a first legal gay wedding is about to be celebrated in France, but 75% of the French electorate think the president is doing a bad job. John Lawrenson, DW, Paris.
And I'm Helen Senian-Bonn. You're listening to Inside Europe. It's now exactly 3 years since Spain began a programme of spending cuts and tax increases. Throughout that time, those austerity measures have faced plenty of resistance. Street demonstrations and strikes have become increasingly common. But one group of Spaniards has found an unusual, musical way of voicing their anger. Guy Hedgeco has been finding out more in Madrid.
I'm in Embajadores, which is a working-class district of Madrid, and I can see around me some of the effects of Spain's economic crisis. Businesses that have been shut down, homes for sale that nobody will buy, and even some beggars on the street asking for money. But another very different reaction to the crisis is inside the building I'm looking at. This building is called La Tabacalera, and it's a run-down old tobacco factory that is now used for cultural and educational purposes. This is Solfonica, a Madrid-based orchestra with a social conscience. The musicians and singers are all volunteers, and they are feverishly rehearsing for the world premiere of a comic opera about Spain's economic crisis. It's called El Crepúsculo del Ladrillo, or Twilight of the Brick, a reference to the real estate bubble that sparked the crisis in the first place.
I'm Antonio Bajo, and I sing with the Solfonica. We want to express our frustration about this crisis, and I think this is one of the most beautiful ways to express our frustration and to push our government and our bank system and financial systems and all of our politicians.
I am Beatriz Vicente, and I am a soprano. This is a great way to show to the whole society that there is different ways to complain about what is the present situation in Spain.
Is this another way of protesting for you?
Yes, completely. We can come here and sing and make it clear how different the situation is to what politicians are saying. So this is completely another way of protesting.
Solfonica's members are part of the Indignados movement, which protests against Spain's political elite and its handling of the economic crisis. They are particularly outraged by the government's spending cuts to health and education and a jobless rate of 27%. Puerta del Sol in central Madrid is the square that gave Solfonica its name. And this massive demonstration, held there last week, marked the Indignados' second anniversary.
Since they rose up in 2011, street demonstrations by the Indignados and others have become more and more common, and Solfonica has often provided the soundtrack. At many protests, Solfonica has performed classical pieces, such as Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. But they're not averse to playing pop music. Here, some of the orchestra's members sneak into an employment office and surprise the jobless people waiting in line with a Beatles tune.
I think it's always a good moment for art to go out to express in those moments of difficulties. And now, of course, is one of that moments.
David Alegre is the director of Solfonica, and he wrote the music to the opera.
There were many musicians in Spain who wrote beautiful music and beautiful poetry against our dictatorship we had 30 years ago. And we try to make people realize that the situation is not so much different of that moment. We have a fake democracy now. They say that all the reforms that they are doing, they are going to bring us the big future. But from the very beginning, those politics bring more unemployment, more wealth for the rich.
I'm back at La Tabacalera, where rehearsals for the opera took place. And now, members of the public are arriving here for the first ever performance of the opera. There's only room for about 300 people here, and the place is filling up very fast, which perhaps isn't surprising, as you don't have to pay to get in. And we're just a few minutes away from the curtain going up, and the atmosphere is really charged and lively, and perhaps a bit more boisterous than you would normally expect just before an operatic performance. The opera is a surrealist microcosm of Spain's crisis. It tells the story of the people of a town who are persuaded by economists and government representatives that they should become slaves to consumerism and economic development. But the economic crisis envelops the town, which eventually rises up and rebels. Spain's economic woes don't look likely to end anytime soon, so the wave of protests will almost certainly continue. But perhaps there will also be other operatic responses to this crisis. Guy Hedgecoe, DW, Madrid.
Well, from austerity to ostentation. And one of the world's most outrageous car rallies set off from the Danish capital Copenhagen this week. 100 predominantly luxury cars were taking part in the Gumball 3000 event. It was a chance for some of the world's richest petrol heads or motoring enthusiasts to flaunt their wealth during a drive that would take them through 13 countries en route to Monaco. Malcolm Brabant was with them at the starting line.
The first off the starting grid looked more like a spaceship than a car, but it was ill-equipped to deal with the teeming rain as it didn't have windscreen wipers. David Hasselhoff, the star of the legendary television series Baywatch, was drowned as he waved off the Batmobile and a slew of customised Rolls-Royces, Bentleys, Ferraris and Lamborghinis. Among the drivers were sheikhs, princes, reality TV stars and rappers. None of the participants seemed concerned about this display of endless wealth at a time of austerity in many countries. Maximilian Cooper created Gumball 15 years ago, and he's well on track towards billionaire status.
Gumball's been described as being the kind of rock and roll rally. How, in your own words, would you put it?
Yeah, for me, it was. I kind of had a decade of being in the traditional motoring world and the fashion world, and I try to kind of combine the two elements, really, and put something on which is obviously... is my car passion and passion for adventure, but with a little bit of added style and sort of almost the music element's important to me, so hence rock and roll.
A publicity-shy Arab prince floors the accelerator of his red Ferrari as part of the soundtrack of this ostentatious event. Most participants are far from bashful about their prosperity, repeating the mantra, if you've got it, flaunt it.
I know an armored vehicle when I see one, and boy, he's going to pay a lot of money in gas.
Rapper Exhibit presents a TV show called Pimp My Ride.
I don't think it's about showing off, because, I mean, all these cars are not supercars. There's a Volkswagen Beetle here. It's not just about showing them out money. I think it's just about, the spirit of, how can we get together and do something positive.
Although Denmark is one of the most prosperous countries in the world, its people tend to be rather frugal. The rich lead understated lives, and so here, at $45,000 an entry ticket, this is a rare display of ostentation.
The attraction of this event is the whole show. I mean, this is incredibly politically incorrect, but everybody's really fascinated by, fast cars and wealthy people.
Esben Pedersen was at the helm of an electric-powered Tesla car.
It is a waste of resources. I mean, it doesn't have a purpose except for displaying wealth and beautiful cars. So in that aspect, it doesn't really serve a purpose, but people are really fascinated. Maybe it confirms people's idea of what it's like to be rich and famous. I don't know, but it definitely doesn't solve the problems of the world, no.
At a champagne gala to get the event underway, the organisers had no trouble defending the extravagance.
Go, baby, go!
The gun was about fun, and, the world is so corporate, and there's so many wars going on in the world, and to do something fun in countries, it shouldn't be looked down upon. I created Gumball out of nothing. I didn't grow up from a wealthy family. I grew up in middle England, regular school, had big dreams, and I've worked hard to achieve them, and Gumball's getting there, but it's not easy, and I'm still working at it.
Baywatch star David Hasselhoff had no truck with criticism about extravagance in a time of austerity. He took a typically American view of success.
It's people that have kind of been successful in their lives are humbled enough to say, thank you very much, go around the world, raise some money and have a little fun together. It's kind of our time out.
You don't think the money's a bit gross in a poor world?
It's absolutely the other way. You can either stay at home and shine your car, or you can share it with people, or you can take 125 fantastic cars around the world where people can come out and see them for free, and they can dream, and they can look at things and have hope, because it's all about hope and it's about living your dreams. And we all come from nothing, and we all come from working really hard to get where we're at, and if you work hard and you continue to hard, why shouldn't you play hard?
The organizers say they'll be raising money for underprivileged inner-city children while partying all the way from Copenhagen to Monte Carlo, where obscene wealth is the norm. Malcolm Brabant, DW, Copenhagen.
Now, does this music ring a bell? It's from an album released 40 years ago this month, and it was a groundbreaking piece of work, with the composer playing more than 20 instruments in a multi-layered recording. The album also launched Virgin Records, and this opening theme was used on the soundtrack to a famous American horror movie, which was also released in 1973. For this month's quiz, we want you to tell us the name of the album and the film. Our email address is europe@dw.de. That's europe@dw.de. Or write to us the old-fashioned way at Inside Europe, the English service, Deutsche Welle, Bonn, Germany. We have 5 prizes to give away and we'll announce the winners next month. We'd love to hear from you. This is Inside Europe and I'm Helen Sini in Bonn. This is Inside Europe and I'm Helen Sini in Bonn. Over the next half hour, is anti-Semitism on the rise in Hungary? How companies are finding it pays to be differently abled? Turning bamboo into bikes in Berlin? And is running the new clubbing for Europe's women?
I think the atmosphere was really great. The energy was up there, everyone was cheering each other on. There was no bitchiness, no pushing or shoving. It was lovely. Yeah, it was fun.
I think this is girl power, and we are very powerful together, and we look beautiful as well.
Stay tuned for those stories and more. The Czech Republic's new president, Miloš Zeman, has become embroiled in his first real row since taking up the post just 2 months ago. He tried to block the appointment of a university professor who'd taken part in a gay rights rally. Critics say the dispute is the first real test of how far Mr. Zeman can flex his presidential muscles. And he's given a considerable wiggle room by the rather vague Czech constitution. Rob Cameron has more from Prague.
Students in the Czech Republic's second city of Brno give a rather noisy welcome to President Miloš Zeman. The president had ignited a row with the country's academic community by his refusal to appoint one of his critics as a professor at Charles University in Prague, saying the man, literary history professor Martin Putner, had acted in a vulgar fashion in public. After a week of protests, Mr. Zeman finally relented, or rather half relented, saying he would no longer block Mr. Putner's appointment, but would decline to hand him his academic title in person, a carefully calculated snub. He addressed reporters after meeting the education minister at Prague Castle.
To the academic community, I'd like to say this. There's an American proverb. You can't have your cake and eat it. It's one or the other. Either you want the president to have the right to name university professors, and in that case, you have to respect the president's right, naturally based on justifiable concerns, to reject some of those nominations. Or you don't want the president to have that right. If it's the latter, then it's time we changed the law on university education.
In 2011, Mr. Putner, a Catholic homosexual and long-time Zeman critic, had taken part in Prague's Gay Pride rally, holding up a banner reading "Catholic faggots greet Batura," a reference to Ladislav Batura, a homophobic far-right politician and government adviser. Mr. Zeman said the banner was vulgar and unbecoming of a professor at the country's most prestigious university and refused to accept his appointment. But the academic community was outraged, pointing out that even President Zeman's prickly predecessor, Václav Klaus, had never dared to block a professorship, although the constitution formally requires his signature. Philip Pospíšil, who helped organise the opposition to Mr. Zeman over the row, says there's much more at stake than just university appointments.
Many had taken this decision as a signal of an attempt of current president to broaden his powers and to step into the areas that were basically forbidden, really, for the influence of the president, testing how far with this new mandate as a directly elected president he can go and what really public opinion allows him.
Martin Putner himself later appeared in front of the TV cameras, thanking those in the academic world and elsewhere for standing up for free speech. Others who fall foul of the president, he said, may not be so lucky in future. Meanwhile, the whole issue of the president's role in appointing university professors has come under the spotlight. The Czech Republic is one of a handful of European countries where this formality still takes place and is seen as something of a relic of feudalism. Even Mr. Zeman himself now says he'd prefer the education ministry to formalise appointments in future, although some say he's merely trying to deflect attention from what is, for him, a humiliating climb down. Rob Cameron, DW, Prague.
The German software giant SAP is to recruit people with autism to make full use of their talents to process information. Autism is a developmental disorder characterized by difficulties in communicating, emotional detachment, and repetitive behavior. But some people with mild autism can perform complex mathematical tasks much better than the average person. SAP's scheme is in conjunction with a Danish company called Specialisten, which means the specialists. It was set up in 2004 with the aim of enabling 1 million people with autism around the world to get jobs. To find out more, I spoke to Steen Tugesen, the CEO of the specialists.
Specialisterne, as we say it in Danish, is basically an organization that was set up by Torkel Sonne when he had his son diagnosed with autism. And in the sort of aftermath, you can say, of something like that, which also has happened to me and our family, we have a son who's now 14. And when that happens, you really start thinking about, okay, that's fine. We know who our son is and what he can, but what about the future? What would that hold in store for him? And Torkel's reaction was really to try to find sustainable solutions for that. And he then got convinced that there was really a significant underutilized potential from a resource point of view in the industry, because so many people that he came across in his work in the Danish Autism Organization were basically people with great talents, but very few of them had a job or had ever had a job. So Torkel's, outcome was to create an organization that would harness the skills of those individuals and really ensure that they could get a meaningful job and actually get to work with things that motivated them.
I believe around 1% of the world's population has a form of autism. As you've just pointed out, there are varying degrees of this disorder. But why are people with autism suited to technology-orientated jobs?
One of the explanations is that autism has some traits that comes with it that often means that you are very much able to focus on a given task over a prolonged period of time at a level that ordinary company employees may not be. Typically, in order to have that level of concentration and focus, it needs to be something that motivates you. So, people with autism are as diverse as any population in society, but we have found out that the group of people that we can in particular help and work with on the autistic spectrum, they have these things in common that when we are able to find out their unique area of interest and match that with a given task or assignment or job, that really then brings out this extreme ability to do something at a very different degree than most other people can do. So concentration fits well with things that has to do with finding errors in something. When you have this passion or talent for detail that our group of people has, that means that when you can match those two, you find really someone could be extremely good at carrying out software tests or quality control or really anything that has to do with large amounts of data or processes that has to be carried out over a longer period of time, repetitive typically, but where kind of the quality is really important in to ensure the right outcome.
Well, I mean, you've already launched a pilot program in India where you've taken on people with autism as software testers. Is their approach paying off?
I think so, because essentially for the SAP partnership, I think this is one of the reasons for why they started really to look at what does this actually mean for both the host organization, the employer, and also for the individuals who participate in this, both employees and the individuals with autism, and, of course, for society. But basically, when you look at this, there's just a net overall benefit from that. The organization get staff who are really good at doing what they do. The employees get colleagues that they really get fond of, and they actually get more engaged in the organization and start to feel an even higher degree of passion for what they do and their ability to help the other people. And then, of course, for the individuals, it just means that they now get a chance to build an independent life. And we can see from all the surveys we're doing with our staff in Denmark and in other countries and people we surveyed before we actually start specialists. And this issue of becoming independent and building your own career, moving away from the parents' home and into your own flat, those are monumental parts of becoming an adult. And this is where I think we get the real benefit to society from, that we turn people who used to be a burden on society into a taxpayer, and we kind of release resources into society from the people who used to take care of those, so people can go to work, contribute to the GNP, and we've got individuals who are now becoming happy taxpayers and making their own living. So.
And that was Steen Tugesen, the CEO of The Specialists, speaking there from Denmark. To Hungary, which is home to around 100,000 Jews, one of the biggest communities in Europe. In recent years, there's been a modest revival of Jewish culture there. Dozens of synagogues have been renovated, and a new community centre has opened. The annual Jewish Culture Festival attracts some 100,000 Hungarians and tourists. But there's growing anti-Semitism in Hungary, much of which has been spearheaded by the far-right Jobbik Party. While the government has taken some steps against anti-Semitism, Jewish leaders say it hasn't done enough. Igal Avidan has more from Budapest.
The Dohány Street Synagogue in Budapest is the largest and one of the most beautiful in Europe. Just down the road from it is the office of Peter Feldmayer, the president of the Hungarian Jewish Federation. He's an eloquent lawyer and the son of an Auschwitz survivor. Feldmayer would rather talk about the revival of Jewish life in Hungary, but instead is preoccupied with a growing increase in anti-Semitism in Hungary. Feldmayer says hatred of Jews has become socially acceptable since 2010, when the far-right Jobbik party entered parliament for the first time, gaining 47 seats. At the end of last year, one of Jobbik's deputies even called for lists of Jews to be drawn up to protect national security.
The rise of the anti-Semitism is just came from political reason. Some groups in the political arena try to make some power, and they can see this is a good topics to go to the parliament. That is the main problem. These politicians, it's most of them young people, well-educated people, and for me, that is the main problem in Hungary. The far right try to build a strategy.
Feldmayer wants to see laws introduced along the lines of those in Germany, which outlaw anti-Semitism even in the internet. Hatred of Jews is also becoming more evident among the young and educated. Just last month, stickers with the slogan "Jews, the university belongs to us, not to you," were placed on the nameplates of the offices of several professors at the Eötvös-Loránd University in Budapest. They signed their action with greetings from the Hungarian students. The Hungarian Jewish historian András Gerő teaches at the university.
You know, it's not a good feeling. Of course, a certain part of students are nationalistic. And of course, they're sometimes close to the anti-Semitism. But it doesn't mean the whole university is on this side, which is a good sign. You know, sometimes I'm on TV and radio show and things like that. And sometimes in the past 5 years, it happens to me that some people came to me on the street and having remarks, go to Israel, leave the country, dirty Jew, whatever you want. So I am generally very polite to them. I try to behave myself as a professor.
Almost all Hungarian Jews are either Holocaust survivors or their descendants. 600,000 Jews were murdered, mostly in the gas chambers. And although most Hungarians didn't protect their Jewish neighbors from deportation, most surviving Jews remained in the country after the war and tried to integrate into society. These days, though, many Jews don't want to be recognized as such in public, and some prefer to remain anonymous when interviewed. This 50-year-old interpreter chooses the pseudonym Lea Weiss. She's appalled by the rehabilitation of the wartime fascist dictator Miklos Horthy, who was the first East European leader to adopt in April 1938 anti-Jewish laws and who collaborated with the Nazis in the deportation of most Hungarian Jews to Auschwitz.
This process is still open for the Hungarian society to face the past and somehow come to terms with the past of Hungary. It hasn't been made yet. Hungarian political leaders, especially on the right, in their gestures, in their politics, yes, they do see a continuation between them and the politics of Miklos Horthy, the governor of Hungary. Statues are erected in the country for his honor or memory, and streets are named after him.
Leah Weiss also criticizes the defamation of Jewish intellectuals who are critical of the government. State-controlled media, she says, calls them traitors. Weiss points out that even in literary circles, Jewish Nobel Prize laureate Imre Kertész isn't regarded as a Hungarian writer because he's Jewish. Weiss says anti-Semitic politicians in the Jobbik party, which is the third largest party in Hungary, are efficiently exploiting the economic crisis to rally against the Jews. Little wonder, perhaps, that she's not sure about her future in Hungary.
It's always on the table, yeah. Staying or leaving. It's not one thing or it's not two things, but the sequence of events, how Hungary has become a place where life is almost impossible. For economic hardship, economic reasons, for political reasons, and if somebody is Jewish, then there is an extra sensitivity whereby we feel that we are not welcome in this country.
Most Hungarian Jews are not thinking of packing their suitcases just yet. But they know the past all too well and remember how persecution began with anti-Semitic verbal attacks. So the community is keeping a close eye on the door. At a recent conference of the World Jewish Congress in Budapest, Prime Minister Viktor Orbán said anti-Semitism was unacceptable and intolerable. But until the government cracks down on the anti-Semitic rhetoric from the Jobbik party, the country's Jews will remain vigilant. Igal Avidan, DW, Budapest.
And I'm Helen Sinian-Bonn. You're listening to Inside Europe. If you've ever seen building sites in many developing countries, you might have marvelled at the strength of bamboo scaffolding. Bamboo is a natural material proven for its durability and high strength-to-weight ratio in construction, housing and furniture. But what about in the construction of bicycles? Well, Guy Deegan has been finding out more in, of all places, Berlin.
It sounds like sawing through wood, but bamboo is a grass, and while it's easy to cut, in its raw form, it's hard to imagine how long tubes of bamboo can be crafted into a proper roadworthy bicycle.
Bamboo is an amazing material, and just about all other aspects, it's like a steel frame. It's very durable, it's fairly light, it's quite stiff, you can make it quite stiff, but really the property that just shines above all the rest is the comfort, the vibration-absorbing qualities of it.
Dan Fogel-Essex is one of the designers of Ortson Cyclery in Berlin. He's fascinated by bamboo and working with natural fibres.
There's a saying, steel is real. Everybody says, hey, steel is the material where you really you get the best ride quality. It rides the best. And I actually want to make a bumper sticker that says, bamboo is realer. I still want to have one.
In a small workspace located within an old railway yard, long strands of bamboo lie on overhead racks. A dozen or so handmade bamboo bike frames are in various stages of construction. Saws, sandpaper and epoxy resins line the workbenches, as well as bolts of natural fibre cloth, the tools and materials for working with bamboo. Together with design partner Stefan Brüning, Dan runs workshops for people who want to make their own bamboo bicycle. They made their first bamboo bike 3 years ago, but Stefan says it barely made it out of the workshop before breaking, and they've learned a lot since then.
There had not been a way how to do it available for everyone in the internet or any place where you could learn how to build a bamboo bike, so we had to figure out on our own, and this development was pretty interesting.
The pair found that tiger bamboo was a good species for producing bike tubes. The geometry of the frame is similar to any other type of bike. However, Dan and Stefan worked out that bamboo bike tubes need to have a diameter of 40 to 70 millimetres for best performance. That's much wider than standard bike tubes.
Diameter. You need the right diameter. That's of all the tests that we've done and all the different things that we've tried, the biggest problem with bamboo is that it tends to be flexible, which is also a benefit. And the super simple answer to making it stiff is just diameter. It's got to be wide.
Joining the tubes together is perhaps the biggest challenge for building a bamboo bike frame. And manufacturers differ in their approach. Some wrap tubes together with strips of hemp and epoxy resin, while others use steel joints. But what happens if you crash your bamboo bike? Stefan says a bamboo tube might crack lengthways, but fixing it should be as simple as repairing a puncture.
You can always ride a bike when the tube is broken at any point. And also you can always repair these cracks, because you can just add some epoxy in between and you can glue this together again quite easily. It's like it's not going to break at the same point again.
So, having seen how the bikes are made, I want to try a bamboo bicycle for myself to find out how a bike made of grass and glue travels on the road.
I've just been riding the bike for a few minutes outside of the workshop, and my first impressions are that the frame feels stiff and it's very responsive as well. I've been going over cobblestones and some uneven terrain, and I must say that you do feel this dampening effect at work. It is quite a smooth ride.
There's a growing demand for bamboo bicycles around the world, with small enterprises building frames in the US, Ghana, Zambia and Singapore. Dan Fogel-Essex says he can see bamboo bicycles becoming more popular, but adds that bamboo is best suited to custom-made bicycles rather than mass production. Both he and Stefan Brüning hope that their frame-building techniques will be adopted by others. But for now, if you see a bamboo bicycle in Berlin, you'll know it's a special one, and it was probably made by the person riding it. For DW, this is Guy Deegan in Berlin.
Well, women across the continent are not so much getting on their bikes, but getting out their running shoes. Five major European cities are staging unique night runs, uniting thousands of female runners in a celebration of sport and style. The events, called We Own the Night, are organised and sponsored by sports brand Nike, and they're taking place this month in Amsterdam, Berlin, Paris, Milan and in London, where the series kicked off last weekend. Our reporter Joanna Impey went along for us.
The atmosphere here in Victoria Park in East London is more like a festival than anything else, with live music reverberating around a cordoned-off area the size of a small field. Around the grounds are chill-out zones, portable toilets, catering vans and hundreds of cables, ready for the light show later.
OK, cool. And I just need to know what time they need to be near the station. We haven't seen the...
It's the early evening and Chloe Shattuck and the rest of the team at Nike UK are running through the final preparations ahead of the 8 o'clock start. Chloe explains what makes this event unique. She talks nearly as fast as she runs.
This event really is about putting on kind of that perfect running experience for a girl, really. So the idea is when you come in, you don't get put in a pen with other girls who've run in the same, who necessarily have signed up to run at the same level as you. if you arrive with your friends, you do get the opportunity to change and actually run with them. We've got lots of beanbags, it's one thing we know. Running events, there's never anywhere to sit, but you're just about to run 10K, so you want to rest. So we've made sure there's plenty of seating all around the area. At the backdrop of that is obviously having some brilliant DJs, so bringing some real life and energy to the experience throughout.
Running, it seems, is no longer something we do instead of partying. It's becoming the party itself.
I don't think it'll ever replace partying, but I think just the idea that people are much more proud to say they're a runner, therefore it becomes a much more social activity because of that. Actually, for example, going and having brunch after a run, like the run part of it's just as important as the brunch, whereas in previous worlds you might have run on your own and then maybe met friends afterwards. It's something you very much do together.
As the DJs get going, the runners start entering the grounds. And in a noisy corner next to the main stage, I stumble across marathon record holder Paula Radcliffe, who's the big name kicking off the event.
I think the thing about running is that it brings you so much, aside from the health benefits and the fitness benefits. It's also a lot of camaraderie, a lot of fun, a lot of self-respect and you kind of self-confidence. You learn a lot more, and I think that's the thing. It's like empowering women, so they go home thinking, yeah, I owned it tonight. I really went out there and I had fun and I learned a lot and I met some new friends and it was a great evening.
We've got marathon queen, Paula Radcliffe.
Paula then steps on stage to help warm up the runners, who are all clad in identical orange T-shirts. It's a bit like watching Soviet-style mass gymnastics, but a lot less coordinated. On the edge of the field, I spot two lone men at a stall selling food. And I ask what it's like to be pretty much the only men in this crowd of some 4,000 women.
It feels pretty strange, yeah. We were just...
Strange is the word, yeah.
I mean, there's that kind of scene in one of the episodes of The Moomins where all of those kind of alien creatures come out of the sea and they're kind of glowing and swaying to and fro, and we feel like spectators upon that spectacle, to be honest. I mean, I do, I don't know about Ed.
No, I feel exactly like that as well.
Well, I've never seen The Moomins, but actually I know just how they feel. I'm pretty much the only person in the grounds not wearing Lycra, and I feel distinctly detached from the situation. All that's heightened when the race itself gets underway.
Are we ready? Let's go! 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, go!
Well, under an hour later, the first runners are already crossing the finish line. I catch up with them to ask what they made of the evening. By now, it's getting dark, and the lighting system is really coming into its own, casting a pink and orange hue on to pretty much everything. All the runners have now been handed glow sticks, so it looks like this could turn into a rave.
It's more friendly, I think.
Yeah.
Because if they were men, they may be more competitive. Well, I know we're competitive as well, but yeah. It's just nicer.
Whether it said we own the day or the night, I still think it's all about empowering women to be strong and be fit and healthy and stay active no matter what age you are.
I think the atmosphere was really great. The energy was up there, everyone was cheering each other on. There was no bitchiness, no pushing or shoving. It was lovely. Yeah, it was fun.
I think this is girl power and we are very powerful together and we look beautiful as well.
Well, I couldn't find a dissenting voice among them. But then they had just run 10K and I guess there were quite a few endorphins knocking around. Oh, and I forgot to mention that everyone had also been given a glass of champagne when they crossed the finish line. Joanna Impeat, DW, at Victoria Park in London.
And that's it for this week's show. Hope you enjoyed it. Emma Wallace helped produce the programme, along with sound engineer Christoph Grofer. And I'm Helen Sini. Thanks for joining me. Inside Europe comes to you from Deutsche Welle in Bonn.